My name is John Cull, and I'm here today with Dr. Christopher Wright, who is a cardiothoracic surgeon and the Chief of Medical Staff Affairs at Prisma Health Upstate in Greenville, South Carolina. He's also the Medical Director for the Human Research Protection and sits on the Ethics Committee and the State Board of Medicine. And he's agreed to talk to us today about consent. Thank you very much, Dr. Wright. So, Dr. Wright, what is the relevance of informed consent in the healthcare and human research?
When patients present for either healthcare or agree to be participants in a research study, they need to have all the information about the risks, benefits, alternatives, risks and benefits of the alternatives, so they can make an autonomous decision. It's obvious that someone presenting themselves to the healthcare system or to a research subject are not content experts in what's going to be done, either from a healthcare perspective or a research perspective. So for them to make an informed decision as to what they want to have done with their bodies and their lives and how that would impact them, we need to have a discussion with them about the risks, benefits, alternatives, the content of what's surrounding the activities that they're going to be undergoing, and then they can make decisions. And that's consent. Consent is when someone agrees, yes, you can do this. Well, we have to ensure that when they say, yes, you can do this, they fully understand what's going to be done with them, what the consequences are, what the alternatives are, what the risks are. Then we can feel comfortable that they're making that decision based on their own personal beliefs and not some deception or other outside desire or influence.
So when is informed consent necessary?
I think legally, and you know, we look at the federal government and the states, anytime something is more than minimal risk. So anytime there's a procedure or an intervention going to perform that's more than minimal risk, the patient needs to be consented. Now, more than minimal risk is a difficult definition, and generally that's left up to, in healthcare institutions, the providers that are delivering that healthcare to make that decision as a consensus, as a whole. What would the majority of people delivering that, performing that procedure, what would they consider more than? You can't have a laundry list because it would be impossible. So a procedure that's not more than minimal risk doesn't need informed consent, but there is a consent to treat when patients come into the hospital. And there's also, if we understand our society, there is an unwritten consent of patients when they present to a hospital for treatment, that the people delivering that treatment and the hospital delivering that care have been vetted, that they are who they are, they have trained the way they train, they have the experience that they have, and that the patient understands that the physicians, the nurses, the technicians are going to use their best judgment, training, and the best interest of that patient to treat them and deliver the care. And that's a kind of an unwritten consent. And that's what we get when someone comes in the hospital and there's that general consent to treat. But there is an unwritten social contract between patients and healthcare institutions, hospitals in particular, where they understand, they don't have to ask that question because that's the general care. But anything above that minimal care, that's more than minimal risk, that would be outside of that, then we need to get a procedural consent or direct informed consent. And certainly research rate rises to that level also, because when we're doing research, we're not doing it for the best interests of the patient per se, we're doing it for some other means. So that's why you would need consent if there's a research project. Even if you're comparing two standard of care procedures, the patient has to know that you're not using your best judgment to choose one of those. What you're using is a research protocol. And that's fine, as long as they understand that and understand the risks of that.
So in research, when can informed consent be waived?
Well, according to 45 CFR 46.116, that's the Code of Federal Regulations. That's the there are four things. The research has to involve no more than minimal risk to the subject. The research could not be carried out practically without a waiver of consent. The waiver of consent should not adversely affect the welfare and rights of the subject. And when appropriate, the subject should be provided with additional information about their participation after the intervention occurs. So to sum that up, a perfect example would be a retrospective chart review, or when you're looking at patients' medical records, because you know, human subject research, a human subject, not only is their bodies, but it's also their protected health information is included in the definition of human subject. So if you're going to access protected health information that they gave as part of treatment, and you're going to be using that for research, that's used for another reason. Now, you can say that that would be not practical to have to go back and consent to all those people, and certainly it's no more than minimal risk to be looking at that record, as long as it's done in the proper way. And the IRB would then say, is the reason that you're looking at that information, that chart review, is it a valid hypothesis? You can answer a question. Is the methodology correct in what you're doing? Are the people looking at it trained and understand HIPAA and other research protocols? And if all that's in place, then you can clearly say you're going to waive consent, because it would be practically impossible to consent to all those people. It's no more than minimal risk, and we're ensuring that the people handling that information are doing it for an appropriate reason in an appropriate way.
Can prospective databases be collected without informed consent if there's not a research question in mind? Or does the necessity to obtain informed consent change if a particular research project is planned?
Well, there's that question has kind of two answers. When you have a prospective database, again, what does the patient understand? The patient understands that you're treating them. Now, if you're collecting data on them and you're going to use that data for quality improvement or some other reasons, then for their care, say you're saving it so you can look to see as they progress if they have a chronic disease over a period of time, that's one thing. If you're going to use that information they gave you for research, that's not why they gave you that information. So if you tell them up front that we're putting this data, your data, into this database, and it may be used in the future for research, and they're okay with that, then you can access that data at a future time for research, as long as the IRB approves that research. The IRB says, well, that's a valid hypothesis, it's a valid methodology, the people doing it are trained, so yes, you can do this study. You're not going to have to go back and consent to any of those patients, because they've already consented for their to be used. Now, if it's a database that hasn't been pre-approved by consent, then kind of the question is, do you have to go back and ask those people, because they put that data in there not knowing what is going to be used? Now, you could argue that if it's no more than minimal risk, it's almost like a chart review. That's what people have done in the past. So I would say what you're doing is, by consenting the patient up front, saying that we may use this data in the future for research, you're kind of protecting them and yourself. If you don't do that, the data is still there. You can access it, but then there's going to be more hoops to jump through and more ethical thoughts that have to go into place before you can access that data. So getting consent for a prospective database just kind of takes care of that up front, that the patient's agreeing to it.
So do different IRBs have different requirements for investigators for consent?
In general, the requirements for consent are driven by the Code of Federal Regulations. As we said before, it's 45 CFR 46, and there are sections within that that deal with the requirements for informed consent and who can obtain informed consent and how it is obtained. So in general, that's what drives the IRBs. Now, certain institutional IRBs may have other local standards they put on top of that, like only physicians can get consent, or only the principal investigator, not the study staff. And there's that could be put on there, but those are like local requirements, not federal requirements. And if you're doing that, my experience would be you should have a good reason for doing that, that you don't think the staff is that there's some reason that you're doing that. But for the most part, obtaining informed consent is, as I said, the person obtaining that informed consent should be involved in the care of that patient or the research that patient's going to be involved in. They should have a thorough understanding of it, a thorough understanding of the risks and benefits, alternatives, and the risks and benefits of those, what the outcomes are, and be able to answer all the subject's questions. And if they can do that, then that's informed consent. Now, anything else put on top of that, certainly local IRBs can do that. It's becoming more and more consistent as to what the IRBs look at.
So how do you deal with ethical approvals through different IRBs?
Well, again, as I said, first you look at the external IRB. Are they AHRQ accredited? Have they had any problems with the Office of Human Research Protection? What kind of studies are they approving? Are they able to handle the kind of study that you're looking at? Have there ever been ethical concerns with that IRB? Do they handle conflict of interest in a way that's appropriate to you? Because even though you use an external IRB in a multi-center trial, the local IRB, if the patients are there, the local IRB is still responsible for the protection of those patients. They're letting the external IRB do the work, but they have the responsibility of checking to make sure it's being done correctly. And that could be as simple as, are they AHRQ accredited? And they also have to supply you with the consent if you want, so you could look at it. They have to supply you with adverse events. They have continued reviews. Any of the things that you want to look at to make sure that the subjects in your institution are being protected by that IRB. So even though you can use other IRBs and they may have some subtle differences in what they have, the ultimate goal is for your local IRB to ensure that the human subject is being protected in research by that external IRB.
So is it important to share the IRB comments with potential collaborators?
I think to be more clear, if you're involved in a research study, a multi-center trial, and your local IRB is the IRB that you're using, you're not using a central IRB, the comments from the local IRB as to consent modification or modification of protocol, any of those things, those should be shared with the study sponsor, not other IRBs. Other IRBs can share information, and IRBs do share information, but it's more important that if your IRB has comments about the study that involve the protection of human subjects or the protocol, that those be shared with the study sponsor.
So who can consent patients for a study?
As I said, the person obtaining consent should be someone that understands what's going to be done to that patient, and they understand the risks, the benefits, the alternatives, the risks and benefits of the alternatives, the adverse events, the outcomes, what's the goal of the study, what's the purpose of the study, the methodology of the study, what the patients to expect, what's to be done to them, what time frame are they doing this, how many people are involved, will there be commercial profit? There's a lot of things that have to be involved that are in informed consent, that as long as the individual has that, that's fine. So for example, in our institution, we've done studies exercise physiology studies where the principal investigator is an exercise physiologist, either a PhD or an MD. But then the patients undergo interventions at different facilities in other places and by trainers or people like that. Now, we would let those trainers obtain the informed consent of those patients as long as we think the risks of the procedure were acceptable for that level of consent, and that that person obtaining the consent understands the things that I just said about. So it's not so much the individual themselves, who they are, what they are. It's how much do they know and how can they present that information to the patient. We would look our IRB if we were having someone other than a principal investigator consent a patient or a subject. What training does that individual obtain in obtaining informed consent? They need to be trained in how to have that discussion, how to answer those questions, and when to say, well, maybe we better ask about that. If you have concerns, we can go deeper into this. So rather than saying it has to be a particular person, I would say it's a person that has knowledge of the study, the risks and the benefits, all that we talked about, and also that there's some indication to the IRB that these individuals have been trained into what informed consent is and the process for it, having that discussion and answering those questions and being confident that the patient is making an autonomous decision. That would be what's more important to me.
Okay. So how do you save the consent? Do you have to have a hard copy, or can it be saved electronically?
Electronically or hard copy. And then there's rules as to how long, once you get a consent, that becomes part of the study record. And there you have to maintain a study record, obviously, during the study. But you also have to maintain those records for a period of time after. And those are according to federal or state regulations. You also have to maintain the originals if there's changes, because otherwise you wouldn't know what happened. So if you alter a consent, you need to have the date when it was altered, the IRB approval, but maintain the original consent so there's a way to track back to see any alterations in the consent.
How do you save consents across institutions?
Again, the data can be stored electronically in a database or even hard copy in a file cabinet. As long as if one of the other institutions asks, we need to see the consent, or we need to be assured about the consent, that it could be produced for them, that they could look at it and understand how that consent was obtained and documented.
So what is a data use agreement, and why is it necessary for multi-center trials?
A data use agreement is a contractual document that's used for the transfer of data between two entities. And the agreement or the contract ensures how the data is going to be used, how the data is going to be stored, who's going to use the data, the time frame for the data, how the data is going to be disposed of at the end, and that's all put down in a contract. And say entity A is going to share data with entity B. The contract would say, if we're going to give you this data, here's the data we're going to give you, no more, no less. This is what you're going to do with it, entity B. This is how you're going to store it. This is how you're going to dispose of it. You're going to ensure us that you're going to follow all state and federal human subject protection and data storage protection regulations. And that's the agreement that's put in place. And entity B, once they have that data, that's all they can do with it. Now, if you're doing a study and you're getting data from another institution and you want to add another study site and you want to share that data with another site, you have to go back to the original entity, entity A, and say, is it okay if I share it with entity C? And if yes, then the agreement has to be modified that A will say the data will be shared with B, and they can share the data under these conditions. And again, the conditions are what's going to be used for, how long it's going to be used, who's going to use it, Where is it going to be? I mean, how is it going to be disposed of? The security, all that.
Okay. And how do you obtain a data sharing agreement with another institution?
Like any contract, it's a discussion that is undertaken with that. So the first thing you would want to ensure is, what are you doing with the data? So if someone came to our institution or our IRB or our Office of Human Resource Protection and they said, if it's a university or some outside entity, and we said, we want some of your healthcare data because we're doing a study in our public health department that needs the data that you have on hypertension or something, we would enter into agreement with them as to, again, what the data is going to be used for, how the data is going to be stored, that they'll ensure the data is used appropriately and the appropriate protections are put in place, and how the data is going to be disposed of at the end. And that's how the agreement would be put in place. Now, if it's non-protected health information that's publicly available, then it's all bets are off. So if there's data that's being published on a outside website or something like that, then of course the other entity doesn't even have to ask you for the data because they can just get it from where it is, because you've already put that data out there, aggregate data. So if you say we have this percentage of hypertensives in this area, or and that's publicly available data, then there's no data use agreement required. Data use agreement is required for that data which needs protection.
So which institution usually draws up the data use agreement?
It's both have to agree. When data use agreements are drawn up, they're drawn up by lawyers, by legal teams, and it goes back and forth. The institution supplying the data develops an agreement, and then the other institution has to modify it, agree to it, and they come to an agreement, and they sign the contract like any other contract. It's like selling a house. How does the seller and buyer come to terms? You know, one initiates it, but basically the document is a living document that the two of them come to agreement on as to how this is going to happen.
So it's usually the institution that that institutes the data use agreement is the one that's providing the information.
That's right, and they're the ones that have to protect the information. You know, remember, the onus is on the institution providing the data, because the patients or the subjects have given the data to them with the proviso that they're going to protect their data and use their data appropriately. That was the consent that they undertook. So they have to ensure that they're going to honor that. So they're the ones that have to protect. But then the other institution has to agree that they'll abide by those rules.
Thank you very much.
All right.